Last time we took note of the fact that in Judea there began to be two major groupings based, the division between them based largely on their socioeconomic position. The upper crust being oriented primarily, though again you have to allow for exceptions, primarily being convinced that the only way they could secure their autonomy on a more permanent and solid foundation was to attempt a facade of Hellenization, that unknown to these people there were others who claimed to be their supporters, who really intended to use this as a springboard to complete Hellenization and really desired to eliminate the distinctions between the Jews and all the other peoples in the area. Now, I think we can appreciate maybe more fully how these people felt or why they felt the way they did if we keep in mind that up until the end of the Persian Empire, you know, from all previous periods up until the end of the Persian period, basically in this area what you had were a number of distinct ethno-religious groups. You had Phoenicians with their particular language and their particular religion and their particular kind of laws. You had Arameans with their own gods and their own laws and their own cultural traditions. You had Ammonites, again, with a different god, different language, different cultural way of life. You had Moabites. You had Edomites. You had Philistines. And, of course, you had Jews. You also had Samaritans as well. But after the beginning of the Hellenistic period and after it had grown for a while, I mean, it existed for a while, again, you've got the same groups but religiously they are all identical except for the Jews and Samaritans. The only groups that were not worshiping the same gods. Culturally, all of them were also identical, even to a large degree the Samaritans, and the only ones who culturally were left being very, very different were the Jews. The only ones who clung to their unique religious, cultural, linguistic distinction. So as before, they had just been one of a large number of different ethno-religious, linguistic, cultural groups. Now they are practically the only ones still clinging to that uniqueness. That causes a lot of the upper crust people to be put under a lot of pressure by those they meet in surrounding areas. You know, what makes you so special that you don't do what everybody else does? You know, it makes them more obvious that they don't fit in, since they're the only major group which is clearly distinct. And so there's a desire to want to be more like the others, to eliminate unnecessary distinctions, which is what motivated those that wanted the facade of Hellenization. Why should we maintain distinctions which aren't essential? What difference does it make what language we speak in everyday life? If we can speak the common language, it eliminates us from being different that way. If we dress like other people, that isn't an important thing. So let's dress like they do so we don't look so obviously different. Let's do as much as we possibly can, which is not essential to our religious difference, that we can do to be like everybody else. We will only preserve what we must that is uniquely different. Then, of course, there were the others who even wanted to give up this last area of uniqueness as well, as I said, who were keeping their true motivation secret. Then, of course, there was the other party, headed by the high priests and supported mainly by the lower classes who are suspicious of anything foreign, and especially Hellenization. And so they wanted to see if they could become part of the Ptolemaic Empire again and return to their temple land status, which would guarantee that they had the right to continue to be different. And so this is where things stood until, because the Seleucid Empire was pressed for money late in the reign of Antiochus III because of their defeats by the Romans, that Jason, the brother of the high priest, approached him and that after the death of Antiochus III, who incidentally trying to raise money to pay the Roman tribute, was actually looting temple treasuries and part of his empire. He was that desperate to get the money. Eventually, when Antiochus Epiphanes comes to the throne, as I mentioned last time, he is very much interested in fostering more active Hellenization of the peoples of his empire as a way of binding it together more tightly, making it stronger, so that he would be in a better position to take over Egypt, and therefore, using the combined resources in terms of money and manpower, he could take on the Roman Empire. And it's at this point that Jason, the brother of the high priest, has come to him and suggested that he should be the new high priest, that his brother is disloyal. He's secretly trying to stage a removal of Judea from the Seleucid Empire, and that he promises to Hellenize Judea. He claims to have the support of the majority of the population, and he even is willing to pay some money for the privilege. And so he does become the new high priest. Now, we enter at this particular juncture, and the year is important. In 171 BC, we have the removal and murder of Onias III. The exact circumstances of his murder is not clearly understood, except he is removed from being the high priest and he is murdered. He is replaced by his brother, Joshua, who takes the name Jason. So what I'm going to do is use a hyphen so that you can associate the two names together. Joshua, who's now... Oops, I did Joshua, Joshua. That doesn't make sense. Joshua, Jason, because he takes the Greek name Jason while he's serving as high priest. And we enter a period of time that lasts until 168 BC, which could be called a period of peaceful Hellenization. Because the only thing that is done is a facade of Hellenization is created. The upper class people begin speaking Greek. They dress like Greek. They introduce the Greek educational system, Greek athletics, Greek architecture. But, of course, they get what they had wanted. They get their guarantee of their autonomy, their charter for their newly formed polis that I described last time, Antioch at Jerusalem, which guarantees they can make their own laws, and they choose to make their laws the laws of the Torah. And they can worship their own God, and they choose as their patron God, Yahweh. And so they feel reasonably happy. Now, what happens in 168 BC that changes this? Again, we have to look to the circumstances of what's going on in the larger area. Remember that Antiochus Epiphanes was very receptive to Joshua's offers because of what he had in mind. He is bound to strengthen his empire and attack Egypt and absorb Egypt and then try to take on the Romans. Well, what happened in 170 BC, and again, you don't have to remember the exact date. These two dates are critically important. I'll put in parentheses 170 BC. You might just keep in mind it was shortly before this second critical date, that he launched an attack upon Egypt on attempting to destroy and absorb the Ptolemaic kingdom. However, he met more intensive opposition than he had expected. They proved to be a bit made of sterner stuff than he had been led to believe. And so he was having very rough going. And at that particular point, he had to break off the engagement. But he renewed it again in 168, this critical year, and essentially beat the Egyptian forces, captured the Ptolemaic ruler, and was ready to achieve his objective of now working to unify these two empires, when a representative of the Romans came to him in Alexandria, and in highly symbolic language, no words were exchanged, demonstrated that Rome was not pleased, and that if he didn't get out of Egypt very quickly and restore Egypt to the rule of the Ptolemies, Rome would immediately make war on him. Well, he was not ready yet to take on the full responsibility of fighting the Roman Empire. He had just newly conquered Egypt. He hadn't had time to organize the resources of Egypt, mesh them with his other Seleucid resources. He didn't think he could win over the Romans, and so he backed out. He backed out. Now, it's at this particular point in time that he makes another change in Judea. This is where that other figure, the one who was the leader of the subgroup of that Hellenizing party, the ones who really wanted to go all the way and give up everything Jewish and essentially become like all the other peoples, came to Antiochus Epiphanes and began saying, you know, this guy, Joshua, Jason, he's not really interested in Hellenization. Sure, some things have been done, but, you know, it's they haven't gone very far. You can't really trust him. Plus, you know, if you were to make me the high priest, I would vigorously pursue Hellenization, and I would pay handsomely for the privilege of becoming high priest as well. And I know you're short of money, and you need more money for your military activities, which I fully support, and I feel that's just a way of my showing you my loyalty with you, to you, is to offer this nice sum of money. Now, assisting him in offering this large sum of money, by the way, is an old friend of ours, the head of the Tobiad family. There's still a Tobiad around. And he naturally sees that he has a lot to gain if Judea becomes Hellenized, because he has already led to the Hellenization of the Ammonite kingdom. In fact, we find a very beautiful, some very beautiful ruins have been found in Jordan, remains of the palace of this family from this period. Very beautiful Hellenistic building. So he's got some also some promise of money from the Tobiad family to pay this huge bribe. And so Antiochus Epiphanes is encouraged, and so what happens is in 168, we have the removal of Joshua Jason, and he is replaced by Menelaus. What makes this particular replacement even more interesting is this marks the end of the high priestly family of Tzadok. Remember, one of the two main high priests that David used was Tzadok, and he was the high priest under Solomon. One of his descendants has been high priest ever since the days of Solomon. Onias III was the last, you might say, legitimate high priest of that line, the line of Tzadok. Joshua did not belong in the office while his brother lived. And after his brother was murdered, it should have gone to a son of his brother. It should not have come to him. Now Menelaus becomes high priest, and he is not of the house of Tzadok. He is not even a descendant of Aaron, which means he is not a priest. It is believed by most scholars he was not even a Levite. He was just an ordinary Jew. And now he has become the high priest of Judea by royal appointment. It shows you what has happened to the office of the high priesthood. What had been before an office which had to be inherited by descent alone, according to being in a certain family, and by scriptural definition, a descent of Aaron, has now become an office which is open to appointment at the pleasure of the king, and you hold the office at his pleasure. If he later becomes displeased with you, you're dropped and somebody else is put in. It is a totally appointive office, and the only one who decides who holds it is the king. This is the complete destruction of the independence of the high priesthood. And as I say, it marks the period where we have, for a short time anyway, not even an Aaronic high priest. You have somebody who was just an ordinary Jew. And never again did anyone of the house of Tzadok rule as high priest from this period on. Now, in the millennium, according to the scriptures we read, there will again be a high priesthood, a physical one, of this house. It will be restored. But this marks the period where it came to an end. Okay, now we come from the period 168 to 164. The period of forced Hellenization. Menelaus had been so greedy to get his hands on the high priesthood that he had promised this enormous bribe and then found he didn't have enough money to pay it. There was a shortfall. Now, he knew if that shortfall was admitted, if he had to go to Antiochus and say, oops, sorry, I thought I could deliver X amount, but I hope you'll be satisfied with this, and I'll try to make it up later. That would not suit Antiochus Epiphanes. He might look elsewhere for another high priest. And so Menelaus, anxious to hold on to his job, dipped his hand into the temple treasury. And I don't mean just the public temple treasury, the monies that were there on deposit by wealthy families, but into the sacred part of the temple treasury, money that was tithe collections and the temple tax collected from all the Jews to pay for the running of the temple services. He dipped his money into the sacred part of the temple treasuries to make up the shortfall and to pay his bribe to Antiochus. What would you imagine many people in Judea would think about this? Not too much. There was a rebellion that almost forced Menelaus out of, not of Jerusalem alone, but also almost caused him to lose his life. The only way he survived was by calling for help on Seleucid troops that had to put down the rioters and literally, from that point on, remain in Jerusalem propping him up because he had no real base of popular support from that time on, except among his immediate associates. Now, put yourself in Menelaus's shoes. He has no broad base of public support. The only thing that is keeping him in office is the support of those troops, who of course are there because the emperor wants them there. He is now in a position that he's got to even redouble his efforts to please that emperor, otherwise out he goes. He is totally dependent for his physical survival and for his holding on to the high priesthood on pleasing his boss, Antiochus Epiphanes. And so with a vengeance, he pursues the policy of Hellenization. And following the orders of Antiochus Epiphanes, this is pushed very, very forcefully. Now, what happens is this, and this is what we have to understand. Antiochus Epiphanes probably never consciously understood that in his forced Hellenization, he was cramming something down the throats of most of the people of Judea they didn't want. He was totally misled, first by Joshua Jason, and then by Menelaus, into believing that the majority of the people wanted to be Hellenized. That it was only a small but highly vocal minority that opposed it. Now, what is it that motivated this small but vocal minority? Their devotion to God's laws. And so we have the opposition in this period, a group who have become known as the Chassidim, or pious ones. That insist they will not give up their fidelity to living by God's laws. They will not give up the pure worship of Yahweh. And as I say, they're becoming a more and more of an important threat to Menelaus. So it occurs to Antiochus Epiphanes, what is it that is supporting this opposition, which is only a small group anyway, he is persuaded. It is the religion of these people. That's what feeds the opposition. Therefore, if you eliminate the religion, the opposition will disappear. And so Antiochus now begins to issue his own decrees. The Sabbath may not be observed. The Torah may not be read. Jewish males may not be circumcised. Festivals may not be observed. And an altar must be constructed in the temple, and swine's flesh must be offered on it in honor of Jupiter Olympus, or Zeus. And so we have the decrees, the very harsh decrees that were aimed to thoroughly uproot the Jewish religion. Thoroughly uproot the Jewish religion. Sacrifices to Yahweh must be discontinued. Sacrifices to Zeus must be instituted, specifically with swine's flesh, which was not always usual. Usually bullocks were offered, or lambs, or goats. But since the swine was an animal that they knew the Jews did not eat, they did that deliberately, you see. Because in any major sacrifice, you know, you also ate of the offerings, and so you had to eat of it too, you see. So it would doubly eliminate this Jewish stubbornness, they felt. And of course, circumcision, the observance of Sabbath and festivals, and the reading of the Torah were all forbidden. Now, all of these harsh policies began in 168 B.C. They continued in force until 164 B.C., when the successful opposition managed to cleanse the temple . We have the cleansing of the temple that took place in 164 B.C., the removal of the altar to Zeus, and the re-inauguration of the temple, its rededication to the worship of Yahweh. So for this period of 168-64, you not only have it extremely dangerous, you might say, to observe any of the Jewish rituals or to refuse to worship Zeus, but also we have a period of guerrilla warfare, where a family that takes over the leadership of this group of pious ones leads a guerrilla campaign to oust the Seleucid soldiers from Palestine. Now, the leader of this guerrilla campaign was a priest by the name of Mattathias. He was not of the house of Zadok. He is an Aaronic priest, but not of the house of Tzadok. But he is a priest. And his sons, the oldest of whom was called Judah, and he picked up the nickname of being called Judah the Hammer. Which translates as Judah Maccabee, or Judah the Maccabee. Consequently, this family group became called the Maccabees, and hence the name of the two books, selections of which I gave you to read from the Apocrypha, the Books of the Maccabees. I might make a comment about the Books of the Maccabees. The first book of Maccabees is a good historical piece of work. It is a good historical source. It's contemporary with these events. It deals with facts that took place. It can reasonably be trusted as much as any other piece of historical work. The book of Second Maccabees is a different sort of book. This thing is a mixture of fact and legend and deliberate invention by the author. And it is frequently hard to separate one from the other. And so at this point in time, some of the material, you know, it's hard to know whether to trust it or not. For example, one of the students in the class brought to my attention a passage in the second book of Maccabees, which you have, which says that when Jerusalem was besieged by after the Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem, that Jeremiah hid the ark of the covenant on Mount Sinai. Now, we read that in 2 Maccabees. Is that historic fact? Is that something that was just a legend of the time, which was true, but only, you know, believed as a legend, though it was indeed a true thing? Or is it something the invention of the author? We have no way of knowing. There was no way of establishing whether that was a known historic fact, though it's not specifically recorded in the books of Scripture. It was known to have occurred, was viewed as an historic fact, or it was generally held by tradition to have been what happened to the ark, and indeed it was true, that's indeed what happened, or is this something the author has made up? We don't have no way of knowing. And some of us, I think, would be pretty interested in trying to figure that one out. But we'll have to wait to Christ's return to find out, or maybe to Christ's return to find out if there's any basis in fact to that. So that's why I said the second book of Maccabees is given to you as a sort of a contrast to the very staid and straightforward narrative accounting of the book of First Maccabees, which deals just with the known facts. Okay. Now, these dates, as I say, are critically important. 171 B.C., 168, 164. Now, you may not know why. It's possible that in another class you've already dealt with this and know why I'm putting such emphasis on these dates. Because what occurs to you about these dates? Yeah. What else occurs to you when you look at these dates? Not the dates themselves. Don't get keyed in by the numbers. But 171, 168, 164. Maybe look 171 to 164, the whole period of Hellenization together, and then 168 considered as where that fits in there. What do you see in it? Mike? Yeah. Total period of 7 years with a right in the middle, 3.5. You have the forced Hellenization, the outlawing of the worship of Yahweh in the middle. For the last 3.5 years of it. So that's something that we will have to take up when we consider the book of Daniel, because this enters into the modern critical approach to analyzing the book of Daniel, as they feel that that part of the book of Daniel, when it talks about that 7 year period or that week, you know, where it says in Daniel chapter nine, that that's Daniel chapter 11, isn't it? 11. That he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week? It is 9, okay. What is it in 11? It's one of they shall cleave to him with flatteries. That's another one that they take into account with this. Meaning Antiochus Epiphanes shall cleave to him with flatteries. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice of oblation to cease. Shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. Yes, the Hellenizers were confirmed with Antiochus in the covenant, an alliance for a week of years. And in the midst of the week, the sacrifice did cease. You see, this is part of that modern critical approach to the book of Daniel. And you will be shortly asked to read, in fact, very, very shortly. Let's see, when is this? Yes, for Monday. Some of these scriptures. It's already assigned in your assignment sheet which scriptures you should refresh your memory about in this assignment. In Daniel 2, 7, and 8, and 9, there are certain scriptures that you're asked to read. And I will make sure that before long today, we have on reserve in the library some commentaries, both from the modern critical and the conservative viewpoint. What you should be doing is looking at those at least one of those commentaries that's written from the modern critical viewpoint as to how those particular scriptures are interpreted. How do they interpret those scriptures from the modern critical viewpoint? Because on Monday we're going to take up the book of Daniel as it's viewed by the modern critical school of biblical scholarship. And that will be something I think you will find most interesting. Okay, let me get back to my main train of thought, and that is the rebellion or guerrilla warfare that was waged by the group we call the Maccabees They eventually succeeded in reaching a compromise with the Seleucid rulership. They never were large enough of a group to militarily be more than, like a bunch of mosquitoes. That's about a good comparison. But eventually the Seleucid emperor was willing to compromise. There were several factors which assisted them in being successful and getting an agreement that gave them relief from this forced Hellenization and the right to cleanse the temple. That's all they got, was religious autonomy was restored to Judea and the forced Hellenization was stopped. Now, why did they succeed in reaching this agreement? First of all, and most important, God was on their side. This was something that God saw as being necessary. Second major area when we talk about physical factors is that the Seleucids were unable to commit large numbers of troops to crush the rebellion. The Seleucids were unable to commit major numbers of troops to crush the rebellion. Their main concerns were Egypt on one side and a new empire which was growing in the east, whose name I think you have heard before, the Parthians. The empire of the Parthians and what is now Persia was, or Iran, was growing in the east, in Iran and in Iraq, using modern day geographical political subdivisions. In Iran and Iraq, the Parthian Empire was growing and becoming a menace to them, and of course they were still struggling over Egypt. That was much more important than this mini rebellion in Judea. It was better to compromise and get rid of it and get on with the big things. Another thing that helped to give the success to the Maccabees is the Seleucid royal family itself was divided. The Seleucid royal family itself became divided into two groups called the Seleucids and Antiochids. Two common royal names in this family. The royal family was divided and warring among itself, between its two parts. This rebellion in Judea was an irritant that was easier to get rid of, and then they could concentrate on their own personal struggle for power. And so these are the factors that enabled them to gain the relief from this oppression by 164. In other words, they were enough of a nuisance that the Seleucids felt it's necessary to deal with these people rather than continue to try to crush them, and we'll just give them their religious autonomy. Now, what happened after 164? Something very, very interesting. Under the leadership of Judah first, Jonathan second, another of the Maccabee brothers, and finally Simon, a third of the Maccabee brothers, Judea successfully enhanced its independence by these steps. Judah secured religious autonomy. Jonathan, and again, I'm skipping over a lot of the details because it's really not essential that we get bogged down with them, was appointed. Now, he was the military leader, Judah, of the rebellion, and he secures the religious autonomy. Jonathan succeeded his brother when his brother was killed as the military leader and then secured appointment as the high priest. Now, at least that was better than what had been before, because you have somebody who is truly in the household of Aaron. After Jonathan was killed, mainly because he wasn't satisfied with this, he was trying to secure complete independence for Judea. That's what the goal of this family was. Judah got the religious autonomy but died trying to secure independence. Jonathan continued the struggle and did win appointment as high priest. The Seleucids hoped maybe that would buy him off and he would insist on full independence, but it didn't, and he was assassinated. And finally, Simon became the next military leader and the next high priest, and he won practical independence. Now, the reason why I call it practical independence, the Seleucids couldn't bring themselves to issuing a command that they were fully independent. They couldn't quite bring themselves to do that. And so, technically, they were supposed to still be part of the Seleucid Empire. But for all practical purposes, they were independent. They owed no tax liability to the Seleucid Empire. They had to provide no soldiers to the Seleucid forces. And they could pursue any foreign policy they desired. And they could coin their own money. These were the essential ingredients of an independent state. Is that they, as I say, they owe no tax liability to the Seleucids. They have no obligation to provide them with any troops. They can pursue their own foreign policy as they see fit, and they can coin their own money. Consequently, they were, for all practical purposes, independent. Now, what enabled them to successfully enlarge their degree of independence? It couldn't have been their military prowess. Little Judea taking on the mighty Seleucid Empire, that's ridiculous, you know. But how many of you saw the movie The Mouse That Roared? Okay, good number of you. Good analogy. A little tiny little nothing principality brings the United States to its knees. Why? Okay, it possesses the ultimate weapon. In this case, it's not an exact analogy, but there's a close analogy to it. And that is, remember, the Romans are watching this with great interest. Because what is the ultimate Roman objective? Which Antiochus of Epiphanes, way back at it, even glimpsed. What is their ultimate objective, Larry? Yeah, take over this whole area. And what's one of those famous little expressions about the best way to take over an area is to what? To divide and conquer. You see, get them fighting among themselves, so each one is weakening the other, and then you walk in and roll over all of them, you see. This was the idea. And so the Romans, seeing what was going on in Judea, made an alliance with the Maccabees. And so basically the line was drawn for the Seleucid rulers. You crush these people, and we stomp on you. And so the Seleucids couldn't, you know, thoroughly crush them because they would bring the wrath of Rome down on their necks. Secondarily, the Seleucids were still struggling mightily to hold on to the eastern part of their empire against the Parthians, a struggle they ultimately lost. They lost the entire eastern part of their empire, and the empire was reduced to only essentially Syria, what's now present-day Syria. And that struggle between the two parts of the royal family continued. And each side courted the Maccabees, hoping that the Maccabees would support their side of the family in the struggle. And so they would win a concession from one side of the family when that side of the family was in control. And then they would secretly negotiate with the side that was out of power, saying, what will you give us if we help you get into the control of the Seleucid Empire? And if they promised them something nice, then they would throw their support to the other side of the family and reap the rewards once they took over, and then they would negotiate again with the other side, you see, back and forth and back and forth. You might say, how can you do that? Well, when you've got these two jealous sides, each trying to come back, you know, that's all they're thinking about. They're not worried about past scores. You know, they want to get back into power. So as I said, the three major reasons they continue to enlarge their degree of independence are the same three, you might say, that gained them their religious autonomy to begin with. The problems with the Parthians, the split in the Seleucid royal family, and the interference of Rome guaranteed that they could slowly but steadily increase their measure of independence until, in the days of Simon, they reached practical independence. And he was free to organize a complete civil government, totally independent of Seleucid control. And so we begin to embark for the first time since 586 BC. something is happening that has not existed since 586 BC. This happens in 142 BC, if I remember my dates properly. Yeah, because the religious autonomy occurred in 164, sorry. Jonathan is appointed as high priest in 152, and Simon gains practical independence in 142. Now, these dates, again, if you don't remember them, I'm not going to get terribly bent out of shape. I give it to you simply as a piece of information. But something has occurred now that has not existed since 586. What? Once he begins to organize an independent civil government. What was lost in 586? Their complete independence as a nation. From that period on, they were always under foreign rule. First the Babylonians, then they passed immediately to the Persians, then they passed immediately to Alexander, then they passed immediately to the Ptolemies, then they passed immediately to the Seleucids. Now, for the first time since 586, they're totally their own boss. They have no foreign overlord that really can tell them what to do. So you have a period of independence, an independent Judea, which lasts for a considerable period of time, which we will trace out in succeeding lectures after we take care of the book of Daniel, is that we have something restored, an independent Judea, but it's different than the old independent Judea. What is different about it? You have a completely independent civil administration, civil government in Judea for the first time since 586, but what is appreciably different? Kevin? Right. He is both religious head of the religious establishment and civil ruler. He is both. He is head of both parts of the government, the religious and the civil. There is no attempt to restore kingship in the house of David. There's no attempt to do that. It's the high priest who is continuing to run the show. Yes.
You were mentioning the military mind of the Maccabees wasn't that great. Yeah, they kind of went on about the great valiant fight of the Maccabees against the Seleucids, a certain battle.
Well, yeah, they were very brave, and they continued to fight against enormous odds, and sometimes won some significant battles. But when they won those battles, it was because the Seleucids had failed to commit enough troops to secure the victory, simply because they didn't have the troops to spare, you see. If they'd had no problems with the Parthians, for example, they could have thrown the full weight of their troops at them, and they would just roll right over them.
That's what I thought. It seemed,
yeah, I mean, one can credit these men with great bravery, them and those who supported them, a great deal of faith, you might say, too, that God would secure the victory for them, despite the fact they were taking on a much more powerful enemy. And I think they saw in their victory not the victory of their own arms, but they saw God's hand in it, in that God prevented the empire from fully mobilizing their resources against them. They saw God's hand in that. And I think probably quite correctly, you know, that's what God was doing, was keeping the Seleucid Empire from being able to commit enough resources to crush them. But of course, they had to do their part. They had to go out and valiantly fight. They couldn't just say, you know, here we go, marching into battle with our Torah scrolls, and God's going to just smite them with a mighty blast, you see. They went out there, and like Joshua, you know, prepared to do war, but relying mainly on God to give them the victory. Yeah, I mean, they were a valiant group of men, and we shouldn't ignore that. One other thing we might mention, this cleansing of the temple began to be observed, the occasion of the cleansing of the temple began to be observed as an annual festival, which is called what in the New Testament? It's mentioned in the Gospels. Feast of Dedication, right? Because the temple was rededicated to the proper worship of God. Now, it's a festival that God did not command to be observed. They chose to commemorate it like we commemorate July 4th, you might say. Though, of course, there was a religious significance and not just purely national. Is that wrong? And the answer, I think, is shown by the Gospel accounts that it's not wrong, because Jesus saw nothing wrong with being there at the temple at the time they were celebrating that festival. You know, there was nothing wrong with that. It just was not one of the set feasts of God in terms of showing the plan of salvation, you know, that he outlines in his annual Sabbaths. It's just an additional festival, just like the Jews still observe a festival, which is not an annual festival, the festival of Purim, which commemorates their deliverance from the hands of Haman, as recorded in the book of Esther. It's something they bound themselves to observe because God delivered them from Haman at that particular time. Okay, we will begin on Monday with the book of Daniel from the modern critical view. Do make an effort to at least look at the scriptures, certainly, and be familiar with the scriptures that are assigned, and to look at one of those critical commentaries that I will make sure by this afternoon are in reserve, so that you get an idea of how they treat those prophecies.